This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Jane Hamden. Thanks for listening. Except for people who live in dangerous neighborhoods, few understand the cost of violence better than city police officers. Veteran Milwaukee cops have found children dead at the scenes of violent shootings, arrested children charged with murder and rape, and happened upon homes that are not fit for human habitation. Milwaukee's new police chief, Edward Flynn, comes to the city with long experience in smaller cities, most recently Springfield, Massachusetts. He joins us during our Project Milwaukee series on youth violence to share his plans for the Milwaukee Police Department. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So you come to the community with many years of police experience, of course, but you're a newcomer, so you come to it with a fresh perspective. So far, your few months on the job, when you look at youth violence specifically, what are you targeting? What needs to be done here first?
Well, youth violence is part of is a component part of the overall violence problem here in Milwaukee. Milwaukee shares with most American major cities a problem with persistent violence in disadvantaged neighborhoods. It's overwhelmingly minority on minority, and in most cities, it's largely black on black violence. We've got an awful lot of handguns out there. They are used extensively in the perpetrating of this violence, and certainly much of the violence is concentrated among young men between the ages of 16 and 25. That's a significant violence-prone demographic, both in terms of victims and offenders.
So in our community, from what you can tell, where are these young men getting these guns? It always seems to go back to the guns, one of the first things we talk about.
Well, I mean, it does, but it's, one of our challenges, quite honestly, is this society is awash in weapons. They are not difficult to come by. A large number of the weapons that we recover were initially legally purchased. It's not at all unusual for someone who is going to use a gun criminally to have someone without a criminal record purchase it and give it to them. These guns sometimes stay with one individual. Sometimes they get passed around. Sometimes they become a form of community gun. But they turn up time and again in crimes. I mean, when I started out in the business, I remember that there was a rush to pass laws against the so-called Saturday night special. And when I started out in the business, you were going to catch somebody with a .32 caliber pistol with five shots in it that might have been 30 years old and cheaply made and cheaply bought. Today, our officers are encountering brand new 9mm, brand new 40 calibers, 45s, 357 Magnums, high-quality handguns that have been, by and large, lawfully purchased, periodically, stolen from someone's house, but they've made their way into the underground economy and are the weapon of first resort.
So you've got the ready availability of guns combined with, it seems like, a culture where if you get angry or you need to retaliate, this is how you do it. So there are tons of philosophies in policing, and I wonder if you could just share with us the ones that you believe in that you're coming to Milwaukee ready to make an investment in.
Well, philosophically, clearly we have to engage with our communities because the communities that are most plagued by violence are the ones that have had the most distressful histories with police. And our challenge is to assertively confront and reduce violence where it occurs, while at the same time not making those communities that are the target of our interventions feel like they're the victims of those interventions. And so that's a real challenge for us. I mean, we've got to be community-based, we've got to be problem-oriented, we've got to be data-driven, but those aren't just words. Community-based means we have to build the police organization up and around the constituent neighborhoods of this city. They all have problems of crime, fear, and disorder, but the priorities and magnitudes of those challenges are very different in some of our communities. I mean, many of our neighborhoods, the worst problem is cut-through traffic and speeders, with the occasional act of vandalism or graffiti, and the even more occasional, breaking into a car. In other neighborhoods, every single night of the week, somebody's shooting a gun at somebody. Those require different police interventions, but all of those neighborhoods require some thoughtful fear reduction strategies as well as thoughtful data-driven policing initiatives.
Especially in some of these tougher neighborhoods, there is an absence of respect for police or even an attitude that, these young people don't care if they die. They don't care if they go to prison, or at least that that's the game, you know, that they seem, the image they seem to portray on the surface. So how do you, if you're an officer, if this is your beat, how do you tell people to go out into these neighborhoods and try to build trust and respect?
Well, you know, that's a much more complicated question than it sounds like initially. You know, we do want to build trust and respect at the neighborhood level. It makes a lot of sense. There are many stresses on the organization to create the time to build that trust. I'm not a believer in special units whose job it is to be nice to people while all the other officers are out there answering calls and chasing people off street corners and going to crimes in progress. We've got to make this the job of the generalist police officer, but we're challenged by an extraordinarily high call load. We are challenged to create opportunities for our police officers to be proactive. I'm a big believer in foot patrols, and we've been investing a lot in these last few months in freeing our officers from their squad, allowing them to park it and walk for a couple hours a day. The main reason to do that is A, to reduce fear, and B, to create relationships and opportunities for idle conversation between police officers and citizens. Another part of it is, one reason problems are so bad in some neighborhoods is informal social controls have broken down. There's no social capital in these neighborhoods. People are literally afraid of their own children. My police officers get dispatched to people's houses to tell their 8-year-old to go to bed, to tell their 11-year-old to go to school, let alone, intervene with, young men who are carrying weapons. I mean, there are real stressors on these neighbors and these neighborhoods. And one of our challenges is to produce that base level of order and crime reduction so that some of the informal social controls and church-based controls and neighborhood-based controls can start to assert themselves.
You get police officers after years in these kinds of environments who, of course, got into this line of work because they wanted to help, most likely, but they become critical of the people that they're there to help. They become cynical because of all these things that you're describing. Is there a way to help police officers project whatever image you think would be helpful or help solve problems in these neighborhoods when they start to feel like they're diametrically opposed to the people that they're trying to serve?
You put your finger on one of the ongoing challenges of our profession. The physical dangers of police work are real and well documented, and there are monuments full of the names of people who've been exposed to them. But the emotional hazards of police work, I think, are ultimately far more debilitating and exact their toll, not only in terms of cynicism, but also in things like alcohol abuse, divorce, suicide, and an overall sense of hopelessness. And it's a sad thing for an idealistic 25-year-old to turn into a hopeless 45-year-old who's just in the middle of the social maelstrom and feels like they can't make any difference, that they're going to that same call. I mean, I know people in my business over the course of my life who've locked up the grandchildren of people they've locked up. All right, that's depressing. And so, in many ways, our officers are challenged to create these provisional solutions to ongoing and tractable social problems. My job and the job of policing strategy is to do two things. Number one, give them a sense of hope. We can make a difference. If we deploy ourselves intelligently, if we pay attention to what we do, if we focus on individuals and locations where crime is likely and most violent, we can profoundly alter the lives of neighborhoods and save the lives of people. And you look at the New York City experience, they literally have saved, when you think about it, something on the order of 10 or 12,000 lives in the last 10 years, given what their homicide rate was in 1994 and what it is now. And those lives are overwhelmingly the lives of minority men. That's altered the character and fabric of that city.
Okay, what are they doing that you'd like to see more of here?
Well, I mean, I think, some of the things that they have done are things that are clearly replicable, and I've done that myself. I mean, a focus on your data, using data to drive your deployments, but also the notion that mid-level managers need to be held accountable for what happens in their area of responsibility. It doesn't have to be the New York model in terms of the New York sarcastic model of humiliating subordinates, but the point is that we can have an impact on crime, on fear, and on disorder. Now, the other thing we need to do is to create opportunities for police officers to feel the support of the community. See, the problem is we get sent to call after call after call, and most of the time the people that called us are locked behind their house dialing 911 anonymously, and the people with whom we're intervening were the last people they want to see. So if you spend all day long with the worst of people and people at their worst, it's going to affect your behavior. My feeling is that when there's a community meeting, I don't want to send a community specialist. I want to send the beat officer, because that beat officer needs to sit with a room full of people who say, we support your efforts, we want you here, we're scared, please help us. And so, as I say, I urge my captains to send the irregular sector car to those community meetings whenever possible.
The stressors that you're talking about on the officers and on members of the community, in the worst case scenario, can result in police brutality. So how do you send the signal to your force that you are not going to tolerate that and build support among the community, but at the same time, build the idea among your police officers that you respect them, you understand their constraints and the stresses that they're under? That's got to be like a tightrope.
Well, restraint is a professional value. And the vast majority of our officers exercise restraint in both the use of their authority and the use of force. There's obviously situations which become international news when inappropriate force is used, and it rockets around the world four times before we've even gotten the names of the officers involved. That's the world we live in. As a practical matter, the use of force is never pretty, even when it's authorized. You know, it is a very common sight to see four or five officers struggling with one person. If you don't want to go to jail, you've got the strength of 10. If all you want to do is go home that night, you have the strength of a normal person. And so a lot of lawful uses of force can look bad and ugly. That notwithstanding, you know, excess of force in which police give in to their emotions is a terrible problem, because what it does, whenever it occurs and is witnessed, it brings into disrepute the entire profession, not just the agency where it occurred. One of the messages we send constantly to our officers here, and it's what I do wherever I work, is officers need to practice restraint, not only in terms of self-restraint, but in responding to the emotional overreaction of their colleagues. It's not enough for you not to engage in excessive force. If you've ever been in a pursuit and your heart's been going about 190 beats a minute and you jump out of the car and apprehend the person who just put you through hell, there is a possibility that you're going to go too far. Not always, but it's there. We've got human beings in this situation. What I need are police officers with the strength of character who'd say, oh, whoa, wait a minute, stop it, who are able to grab each other and hold them back, not just hold themselves back. I think it's doable. I've seen it done, and I think it's an obligation we owe to each other not to put our colleagues at risk of losing their job or going to jail because the emotions got the better of them. You know, these acts of excessive force are very, very seldom calculated acts of a cynical, prejudiced person who decides to have sport. They're almost invariably high emotion situations in which someone loses control. Still wrong, still inappropriate, there still needs to be accountability, but it's an emotional overreaction.
You come to Milwaukee with a lot of support from this community for these ideas that you've been talking about, even though you're an outsider, and that's something that's unusual in Milwaukee. In your last job in Springfield, Illinois, though, you left some...
Massachusetts.
In Springfield, Massachusetts, you left with some cynicism there. And a newspaper columnist, I think it was, called you Fast Eddie. You were there for a few years out the door. What guarantee is there to this community that you would stick around long enough to take these ideals and put them into practice?
Well, I mean, there's a couple ways to answer that question. First, if somebody hadn't, you know, reached out to me from Milwaukee and said, would you please be part of this process, I never would have gotten in trouble in Springfield nor gotten asked this question in Milwaukee. So it's Milwaukee's fault, first of all.
If you're asked to leave, you can always say, I can't, I'm honoring a contract.
But the bigger picture is that over the course of my career, I've stayed, you know, I was five years in every chief's job I ever had before Springfield. This is a unique set of circumstances. We've made a major impact there already. But the fact of the matter was that this is a place I very much wanted to be and a set of challenges that I very much wanted to confront. And so I made a career-based decision. And I think anybody in public life at some point in time has to confront the stress between their ideals and their ambition. You know, I'm probably the only business in the world in which I could be pilloried and excoriated for making a career decision to take on a greater set of responsibilities. But I do function in a political environment, so obviously my career decisions will become grist for the political mill. But the bigger picture is that this was a remarkable opportunity in a remarkable city, and I wanted to make a difference here.
So specifically, again, looking at youth violence and the fate and the situation of young people in Milwaukee, what changes in the next, let's say, couple of years are citizens of Milwaukee and the police force that you're now in charge of going to see? What's going to be different in this city? And are you saying, I can get the crime rate down? Or what are you looking ahead and promising?
Well, the first thing is to keep in mind that the police department does not control all the variables in crime from a macro point of view. We can make, I think, a very distinctive contribution tactically, temporally, and spatially. You know, we can identify a neighborhood that's at risk, that's got problems. We can analyze the problem. We can develop an intervention that will have an impact on that problem and for some period of time abate it. The problem will reoccur if nothing else changes. So my tactics and strategies, although effective, will always be to some extent contingent. Other variables are at work. And if nothing else changes, then I will always have youth crime to deal with. It will abate periodically in response to our strategies, and then those young people will be replaced by other young people if nothing else changes. Now, other things have to change if police tactics are going to be successful. I can create the calm in which improvements can be made, but that can only last so long. If nothing else changes, there will always be a new generation of angry young men with access to firearms who will use those firearms to settle their arguments. Cultures have to change. Opportunity networks have to be developed. Jobs have to be developed. You know, we have to do a better job identifying earlier kids that are headed off a cliff. We have to be more imaginative with our juvenile justice system, which is extraordinarily unimaginative right now. The vast majority of my victims and perpetrators had juvenile records. So what? Nothing changed in their life. What good did that system do to them? They didn't learn anything from it. So there's a lot of systems that need to be examined, a lot of people in the neighborhood that have to get engaged in the lives of their young men. As I said, I think the police department can help for some period of time develop the calm in which those informal social controls might be able to work. And we've got to reduce the violence. But we'll reduce the violence only for a period of time unless other changes occur.
Well, Chief Flynn, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Edward Flynn is Milwaukee Police Chief. He was the unanimous choice of the Fire and Police Commission and has the strong support of Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett. He was sworn in January. There's a link to Chief Flynn's biography at our website, WUWM.com. Coming up next, a Milwaukee activist reaches out to families and examines the big picture.
Whether you live in a community or a neighborhood that you might perceive as safe, you're paying for the activities and the violence and the disruption that occurs in other areas of the city.
Project Milwaukee continues in a moment here on WUWM.